Well, thank you so much for braving the rain, braving the elements for coming. Oh my gosh, this is amazing. We'll start off with source number one. Source number one is Rabbi Ismar Sorsch. He, in the year 2003, was the head of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And he has something fascinating in source number one. The head of Conservative Judaism's flagship institution is arguing that the movement made a mistake when it issued a landmark ruling a half a century ago permitting Jews to drive to synagogue on Shabbat. Rabbi Ismar Sorsch, Chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, made this declaration last week in Dallas during a speech at the biennial convention of the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. By sanctioning travel on the Shabbat, he said, the conservative movement gave up on the desirability of living close to the synagogue and creating a Shabbat community. And with this, we begin. Oh my gosh. Already, about 54 years ago, the second most circulated magazine in America was? Not Life. Life was number one. But what was number two? Number two was Look magazine. So 54 years ago, they had a very famous cover story. My mom has mine. She's actually sending it from Eretz Yisrael. So hopefully I will bring it next time because I actually bought this off of eBay. A cover story called The Vanishing Orthodox Jew. That 54 years ago, with all certitude, they said there's no such thing. Jews, as we know it, will not exist. And this is already, this 54 years ago, it's not going to happen. In the words of Rabbi Benjamin Blech, he said, quoting the immortal words of Mark Twain, he said that the report of our death was very much exaggerated. Very, very much. Yet the cover story in its milieu was absolutely true. Orthodox Judaism was at an nadir. What was going on at the time? And why was it that this cover story, it really was true? How is it that nowadays it's the total opposite? How is it nowadays that we're so strong? In fact, if you take a look at that time, I always quote this, I'm sorry if I've quoted this multiple times before, if you take a look at the beginning of the third chelik of Achiezer, which was written by Rav Chaim Ozer Gazensky, the introduction says, this was written in the late 1930s, better to deal with all of the physical dangers here in Europe than to go to America and deal with the spiritual dangers inherent in moving to the, I know I'm Sephardic, but I'll use it, Golden Medina. In terms of, thank you. I guess I said it correctly. In fact, Orthodox Rabbi Jacob D. Gordon said in 1946, there will, God forbid, come a time in which one will see the type of a real Jew in a picture, in chronicles, or in an antique house. Judaism was basically done. Now, how does it happen that nowadays Orthodoxy seems to be, quote-unquote, triumphant? And how is it that conservatism, that the conservative movement ended up being the powerhouse of the 1950s, and now is very much a marginalized movement, which is seriously debating whether or not interfaith marriage is something that should be accepted? How did this happen? So Bezrat Hashem, tonight we're going to talk about this. And it's very, very, very controversial. In fact, when Rabbi Sorsch said what he said in 2003, there was so much against him, so much vitriol. People disagreed and argued with him and back and forth. So tonight we're going to see why this is so important and what it actually did to the conservative movement. So, moving on. Oh my gosh. This is my home. Oh my gosh. Sherith Israel, the very first Jews, is not their very first building. What happened was they were running away from Recife, Brazil. 26 families. They came to New Amsterdam. That horrible person, Governor Stuyvesant, he was a rasha, said, I don't want these Jews in here. It didn't make a difference. They came, and they started Sherith Israel, the very first congregation in 1654. It's very, very difficult to talk about the term orthodoxy, because they didn't have rabbis. They, in a way that, like, we can't even, like, understand, they didn't really even know what was going on. Normative halacha was very, very, very difficult to understand. There was no rabbinic leaders, just so many different problems. However, outwardly, they were very, and according to us Svardim, this is what we are, quote-unquote, traditional. So it's true that you might not keep all of the strictures of halacha. However, it's not that you don't believe in them. Publicly, you wouldn't do anything, you know, to draw the ire of fellow Jews, of fellow practitioners. You wouldn't do that. However, you know, you weren't like, there was no such thing as quote-unquote Orthodox. And I'll give you a very good example. Early in the 20th century, when Judge Benjamin Cardozo, possibly the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice, I don't know, maybe, So basically, Judge Benjamin Cardozo, when they were discussing in the early 20th century, if Sherith Israel should turn into a mixed pew synagogue, he got up and he said, I know I'm not very religious, but I want to go to a congregation that my grandparents, my great-grandparents, and my great-great-grandparents would be comfortable going to. And for Sephardim, especially the early Sephardim, that's really what it comes to in terms of that's really so important. Tradition is what's important to them. So where did the first break with tradition really come in America? Because it certainly wasn't with Sherith Israel. So you take a look at Kahal Kadosh Bet Elohim in Charleston, South Carolina. Oh my gosh. It was founded in 1749. It was totally Orthodox. In the 1830s, there was a small group of reformers who wanted a whole bunch of different reforms, including mixed eating. They broke away. Their small congregation died, but back in the 1840s, it came back. And here in 1840, in Kal Kadosh Beit Elohim, it became totally Reform. At the time, the greatest rabbi in America was a rabbi named Rabbi Isaac Leiser. He was the reverend of Sherith Israel's sister congregation in Philadelphia called Mikveh Israel. Also gorgeous, also a great place to go to. Rabbi Isaac Rice eventually also comes. He was a great Talmid of a great rabbi named Rav Avram Bing. Rav Avram Bing, I have a PhD paper all about how important he was. He was a tremendous, tremendous person. Big student of Rav Nussan Adler, the great rabbi of the Chasam Sofer. So Rabbi Rice comes to America, to Baltimore in the 1840s. But it's very, very difficult because at the same time, who else is coming? Some of the greatest reform leaders in Europe are coming to America. And they are making a very, very, very big, big change within American society. So in the mid-19th century, Isaac Meir Wise moves first to Albany. And I'm not going to steal all of Rabbi Moskowitz's thunder because he's talking about this in a couple weeks. But Rabbi Wise said that it was an accident that mixed pews started in America. He says it was an accident because it's a whole story about how he got punched. I don't know if anyone knows the story. It's hilarious. He was a rabbi in Albany. He wanted reform for his congregation in Albany. So what happened was they fired him. However, he was looking at his contract. He's like, no, I'm not really fired. He comes back Rosh Hashanah morning. He's sitting at the, you know, on the bima. The shul president comes over and is like, what are you doing here? And he's like, what do you mean? I'm still the rabbi. The shul president goes, cocks his arm, boom, and punches him in the face. Huge melee. The police were called. It was a whole thing. So he started his own congregation. They were only able to get a Baptist church. Baptist church happened to have mixed seating. So therefore, he ended up having mixed seating. Very interesting. Okay. Eventually, it's a weird story. Trust me, we're beginning a whole thing full of very, very weird, weird stories. So in 1875, he ends up starting Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he graduates his first rabbi class in 1883. And he graduated that first class. However, he also had a dinner. And when you talk about moments that mattered, this next slide is probably the very thing that changed everything in America, called the Treifa Banquet. The Treifa Banquet. I don't know if you guys could tell. I'll read off some of the things that are over there. I wrote it over here. So what happened was, the menu was treif meat, totally non-kosher meat, little neck clams, soft shell crabs, shrimp, and frog legs. Delicious, oh my God. I don't know. But that wasn't the coup de grace. That wasn't like the big problem. What was the big problem? They served a dairy dessert. Oh, what a shanda. Oh, my gosh. So bad. It's terrible. So, I know. Part of our family's Dutch. So, like, my wife, like, lost out on that part. Instead of waiting one, she waits six. It's terrible. So what happens is that when this was brought to the attention of Rabbi Wise, he doubled down. And even though he claimed innocence, oh, I didn't know what they were going to serve, I had no idea, he doubled down. And he said that he dismissed what he called kitchen Judaism, and he argued that dietary laws were obsolete and cheapened the Jewish religion in the eyes of others. And he said that there was no problem at all, that the entire halakha has changed. Then, in 1885, Wise chaired something called the Pittsburgh Conference, where they end up having the extremely famous, which we've spoken about multiple times before, the Pittsburgh Platform, where basically reform breaks away. Reform says we don't care about Messiah, we're not going to Jerusalem, we're never going, there's no such thing about all of this stuff. Basically a total break. And in fact, they wrote, "We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, discarding a messianic return to Israel and basically all halachic strictures." Oh, so what was going on in the Orthodox world? The answer is not very good. This over here is Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. It was a European-style cheder, and it only went up to around the age 12, 13 years old. And at its most, it only had 100 to 200 pupils. Sounds pretty good, right? A yeshiva having 200 people in it? No, it was pretty bad. Because during this time, 2.5 million Jews came from Russia and from Eastern Europe. They came to Lower East Side, and there wasn't any institutions for helping them. Not to mention there was so much pressure to Americanize. America was known as this huge melting pot. It's not like nowadays where the more individual you are, the cooler you are. You know, the more you could, you know, become an Instagram star or whatever. I'm not really familiar. Oh, no. We're going to talk about RJJ. Oh, my gosh. No, RJJ was not there. RJJ is later. Eitz Chaim did not have any secular studies on purpose. It was very much in the vein of European style. Only Torah, Rach Torah. That is it. Just Torah. That lack of curriculum, especially for, you know, young people who want to really become Americans, that was a very, very, very big problem. And that's why many people did not view Eitz Chaim Yeshiva to be a viable option to send their kids to. So was there an alternative? Was there a middle between the very right-wing Eitz Chaim Yeshiva and the extremely, extremely left-wing, I guess they're in like a totally different house, totally left-wing HUC Hebrew Union College? Was there a center? Anyone want to tell me? What was the center? Anybody? Oh my... What? Oh, so I was waiting for that. Because you know why? That's not what I'm going to say. The reason why... Oh my gosh. The Jewish Theological Seminary. The Jewish Theological Seminary was started in order to be that option. And it started in the year 1887. The main reason was to create a traditional institution for training rabbis who were familiar with the immigrants' challenges, yet also spoke their language. They spoke English. They knew the challenges that the American youths were dealing with. And it even had the approval of RJJ, Rav Yaakov Yosef. He absolutely supported it when it started. Absolutely supported it. And who was the main benefactor? A fascinating figure. Jacob Schiff. Oh my gosh, Jacob Schiff was a fascinating person, kind of schizophrenic religiously. When he was a youth in Germany, I shouldn't even say a youth, in Germany he went to Orthodox synagogues. But because of his German upbringing, and here in America, unfortunately, many, many German synagogues really went way of reform. Here in America, he was reform, but yet he was very traditional in very interesting ways, very, very interesting ways. So, for example, he would conduct business on Shabbos, but he wouldn't write. He just wouldn't write on Shabbos. That would be the thing. They even tell a story that one time, someone brought him a huge contract, and he said, "I'm sorry, I can't sign it on Shabbos." And they couldn't believe it, and they ended up doing the deal with him anyway, because he was, you know, so close to his Orthodox values by still working on Shabbos. Okay, so what happened was, Jacob Schiff was fascinating. So much so that he was so against Russia that he actually provided the money. This is all written in Marvin Tokayer's incredible book, that he was the one who floated the loan to the Japanese for the Russo-Japanese War. Everyone thought Japan was going to lose the war against Russia. The only financier that would give the loan was Jacob Schiff. this ended up having far-reaching consequences, including moving the entire financial center of the world from London to New York. And also, it gave the Japanese an outsized, I guess, idea of Jewish power. So much so it would last all the way until World War II. And that was actually part of the reason why the Japanese helped save Jewish people during World War II, the famous Sugihara. I know we've discussed this in the past. So Jacob Schiff was fascinating. He also gave money to Yeshiva University. Very, very interesting person. So who was the first person in charge? Who was the first person in charge of it? It was a rabbi named Rabbi Sabata Morez. He was a rabbi at Mikveh Israel. Once again, an Orthodox congregation. And he at the time was known to be the greatest spokesman for traditional Judaism in America. Who was the very, very first graduate of JTS? Oh, this is amazing. I actually put his picture over here. That over here. Anyone know? No? Anybody? That's J.H. Hertz from the famous Hertz Chumash, who I love when I was a kid. My dad's a shul rabbi. So, you know, my dad would be busy conducting, you know, all sorts of rabbi stuff. And I would just sit there reading the Hertz Chumash. It was a lot of fun. I don't know. My idea of fun is very different. Okay. Sorry about that. Rabbi Hertz was fascinating. He was also a funny guy. He one time visited Rhodesia. He visited Rhodesia, modern-day Zimbabwe, when he was the chief rabbi of the British Empire. And what happened was he visited all of these Jewish towns. And what happened was is that he ends up leaving, going onto the train, and a certain Orthodox member came from a congregation and was running after the train and said, Rabbi, you didn't visit our community. Please come back. So Rabbi Hertz asked a question. He said, how many shases do you have in your, how many gemarot do you have in your city? So he said, oh, we have a whole bunch. So he told him, he said, if you have that, you don't need a chief rabbi. Which is very nice. He was a very humble person. Very, very interesting. So the school was influenced by the very first JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary of Breslau. This has gotten a lot of, historical revision. It was started by a person named Dr. Zacharia Frankel. Now, he is a very, very controversial figure. In fact, Dr. Schneier Lyman, recently wrote an article in Tradition where Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who we'll talk about in just a moment, who's basically the forerunner to all modern orthodoxy, he said about Dr. Frankel, even those who opposed Dr. Frankel, blessed memory, had to admit that he was a distinguished rabbinic scholar. He had a lot of respect for him. It was a very, very interesting place. In the beginning, it absolutely was, it was definitely traditional. So that started in the response to reform in Germany. I mean, it sounds familiar. The other institution that also influenced, but I would say even more influenced, the Jewish Theological Seminary of America was the Hildesheimer Seminary. The Hildesheimer Seminary was started by Rav Israel Hildesheimer in Berlin. Many, many, many great rabbis. Many, many, many great rabbis were the Rosh Yeshiva. So for example, I know we've spoken a lot about the Sridei Eish. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hildesheimer Seminary. Also, very importantly, the Melamed Lehoyel, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, whose entire mahut, everything he did, was fighting against reform. His own son-in-law, Rabbi Alexander Marx, ended up becoming the librarian and teacher at the Jewish Theological Seminary. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting. And what happens is that there was always this latent tension within JTS. Is it more like the more scientific? Is it more like the Wissenschaft der Judentums of Frankel's institution? Or is it more like the Hildesheimer Seminary, which was way more traditional? And that was always a very, very big issue. Big issue. In fact, it was, once again, starting off, it was absolutely orthodox. So much so that Rav Yaakov Yosef's right-hand man, Rabbi Yisrael Kaplan, sent his son, Mordechai, to go to the Jewish Theological Seminary, obviously after completing Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. Mordechai Kaplan, keep that a little bit in mind. Later in 1897, immigrant Orthodox rabbis made a yeshiva, and this is where we finally get into Ritz. Yeshivat Rabbein Yitzchak Hanan. This started, and it was like really a continuation. It was supposed to be a continuation of Yeshivat Etz Chaim. The rabbis were very hardline traditionalists, and they turned off a lot of the students. And if you read, like for example, Rabbi Rakefet has a fantastic book about this. He was recently in South Florida. Rabbi Rakefet has a beautiful book all about Dr. Revel. And Dr. Revel, he was Dr. Dov Revel, he basically fixed the entire institution to a very large degree. But he only came in 1915. Before then, things were a disaster. You had teachers going on strike. You had students going on strike. It wasn't very good. And for that reason, that's why a lot of people said, why should we deal with a seminary like Reitz that has so many problems? Let's go to JTS, which is absolutely traditional. In fact, even those people that opposed the seminary, like Rabbi Bernard Leventhal, who passed away in 1952, he was the head of the Agudas Harabonim. Agudas Harabonim were the people in charge of Reitz. Even him, he sent his son to JTS. So you're saying one of the main people who was critical of JTS sent his own son to JTS. So and he had all sorts of meetings with Solomon Schechter, very interesting, which is what we're about to get into now. So what really was the boon? What was the coup for JTS? The main coup for JTS was getting Solomon Schechter. Solomon Schechter, fresh off of the entire Cairo Geniza find, and in fact, he packaged a whole bunch of the Geniza and moved it to JTS when he came from Cambridge. He was an Orthodox Jew. The biggest problem people could find with him is that he carried an umbrella on Shabbat. But he was very careful to open up the umbrella before Shabbat. It's very interesting. That was the biggest thing they could find about him. I'm telling you, it's a very big... That was it. He was very, very traditional. In fact, most of his Geniza studies, and this is all brought down in an amazing book by Adina Hoffman called Sacred Trash. Highly suggested. Very, very good. All about the Geniza find. Part of what Schechter was trying to do, he was really trying to show that many Midrashei Chazal, that many rabbinic teachings were they go back to early, early antiquity. So he was really trying to show that Chazal and the rabbis, that really it's so, so old. He was very, very much against the whole documentary thesis. He was extremely orthodox in this regard. He thought the Torah was true, and he disagreed with any of this type of scientific, all of this biblical criticism, very, very, very against it. So what did he want to do? His goal was to combat reform by bringing rabbis with academic degrees, but yet who still had a tremendous fealty to Judaism and to Halakha. So who did he bring? He brought Rabbi Israel Freelander. Rabbi Israel Freelander, along with Mordechai Kaplan, was one of the starters of the Young Israel Movement. One of the founders of the Young Israel Movement, Rabbi Israel Freelander. Who else? Rabbi Dr. Louis Ginsberg, who I happen to have an entire biography of his over here, written by his son. It is a hilarious, hilarious read. I finished it in one sitting because I couldn't put it down. Oh my gosh. It tells an amazing story that his father was so frum. His father was so religious, he would never ever miss minyan. So he actually learned in a yeshiva called Tells. So in order for him to get from his town to Tells was about a 3-day journey if you miss minyan. He describes that his grandfather, it took them 2 weeks to go from their town to go to Tells because his father would not miss a minyan. I mean, it's great. In fact, they say about him, he passed away in 1959. What caused him to finally succumb to his final illness? Someone wrote him an anonymous letter that said, "Your father is rolling in his grave, seeing what happened to you, Louis Ginsberg." And because of that, he ended up passing away. However, very much at the time, Louis Ginsberg was a rising star, someone who was a Talmudic scholar, and someone who, you know, to a very large degree, seemed to be very orthodox. Who else? The aforementioned Alexander Marx, the son-in-law of the Melamed Lahoil, the former Gadol Hador, the son-in-law of Rav David Zvi Hoffman. And it's so interesting. Why is there a need for two different institutions, for JTS and YU? And if you would say that maybe they should merge, that almost happened twice. One time during the late 1910s, they talked about merging. And number two, it happened in the mid-1920s. YU and JTS almost merged. As Professor Kimmy Kaplan, he has a great article about this entire period. I highly suggest if you want it from me, email me. I'll send it to you. It's amazing. He wrote, "To be sure, all those involved were well aware of the differences between the two institutions, but the overall assumption was that they had much in common, enough to combine them and create one strong institution." And please, I direct you to source number two. This comes from a monograph by Jonathan Sarna's brother. Oh my gosh. This is available for $2.99 on the Kindle store online. That's the only place you can get it from. It's incredible. Jonathan Sarna, I'm actually using his book for part of this. It's fantastic. He's great. Very good. I mean, his father used to be my neighbor over there in Montoya West, Professor Nachum Sarna. Oh my gosh. So when Nachum Sarna was given the job at JTS, he describes over here, David Sarna has this small monograph. It is hilarious. First of all, he didn't do any editing to it, which is really funny because he's a published author. But like, he didn't do anything. So he just like goes off. It's amazing. So you can see over here. "Why did we move from a house in a pretty and safe suburban Philadelphia neighborhood?" You know, his father was at Dropsy College, which is currently University of Pennsylvania, "to a small apartment in Morningside Heights on the edge of Harlem and located in a dangerous neighborhood to boot. Answer, there was a rule about it. Seminary faculty had to live within walking distance of the seminary and were required to daven, attend services, on Shabbat and on Jewish holidays at the seminary synagogue, then known as the Unterberg Auditorium and located in the seminary's windowless basement. As a young scholar working at the notoriously parsimonious JTS, my father couldn't then afford the nicer digs along Riverside Drive, where we eventually moved 6 years later thanks to a book contract and his discovery of the lecture circuit." He says that every Shabbos morning, when they first moved to Morningside Heights, every Shabbos morning, their phone would continue going incessantly. And they obviously didn't answer. They were Shomer Shabbos. And it kept on going. Eventually, they found out, Louis Finkelstein, who was the head of JTS at the time, he's the one who comes after, he comes after Solomon Schachter. Think so? Yeah, Louis Finkelstein. No, after Cyrus Adler. Sorry about that. I have his autobiography. It's fascinating. Very strange. So what happens is that Louis Finkelstein got his non-Jewish secretary to call on Shabbat morning to test and see whether or not the Sarnas were religious. Can you imagine that? At JTS nowadays? Oh my gosh. It's amazing. I love it. And it would just ring incessantly for the first few months. And then, you know, then finally it stopped. And if you take a look past page 5, I'm sorry about the numbering in this. If you take a look past 5, it says over here, the world of halacha. It's a little chart I got over here. I got this online. Fantastic. Has over here. It's great. It shows you how halacha should be decided. It starts with the Torah, the Mishnah, the Babylonian Talmud, the commentaries. At the very end, the Committee of Law and Standards for the Conservative Movement. It looks pretty firm to me, right? It seems pretty good, no? Right? No? Okay. I know, because you guys already know the ending right now. In addition, we didn't even talk about any of the financial stresses that were inherent during this time. The very famous story, very famous saying, if you're not going to be here on Saturday, don't bother being here on Monday. Because if you don't come on Saturday, you're absolutely fired. This is a time before any sort of, you know, societal benefits that we have nowadays, like welfare, food stamps, all of these different things. We just don't have them. And yet there were some people who stood up to this. My favorite example is a great, great person named Harry Fischel. Harry Fischel has an amazing biography written by his son-in-law, Herbert S. Goldstein. Oh my gosh. He was amazing. Oh my gosh. He was a rabbi in Harlem. Oh my gosh. Oh, he has biography. I mean, he has an autobiography and like whatever. It's amazing. Oh my gosh. He was amazing. Sorry about this. I just love him. In fact, he was the only person who wore a kippah at the JTS graduation. He was the only person who wore a kippah at his, and he got up and he blasted Mordechai Kaplan, who at the time was the head of the TI, the Teachers Institute at JTS. But that's going into a totally, totally different thing. So, Jews were moving to the suburbs. Jews were moving to the suburbs, and there became a huge transformation with the work week. Rabbi Charlap, my Rebbe, I had a charusa with Rabbi Zvulun Charlap. I'm so lucky, Baruch Hashem, it was amazing. So he told me about his father starting a Hashkama Minyan in the Bronx. Why did they have to have a Hashkama Minyan? Because you daven first early on Shabbos morning, then you go to work. Oh my gosh. Oh my, yes, I certainly hope. I was walking my son Chaim around the circle, and he saw a car, obviously a Jewish person, whatever, on Shabbos. And my son Chaim, he's 5, he says, oh my gosh, I hope they're okay, because they're going to the hospital. I'm like, oh yeah. I'm like, I hope so also. So what happened was, is that at first it was very difficult, but then going into the 1950s, you end up with a 5-day work week, you end up with people moving to the suburbs, people getting a lot more money. And Jonathan Sarna has in his book, he has a whole bunch of different reasons why people move to the suburbs. And I will read to you in short, I mean, he goes on for a long time, what it was. Number one, the alluring new homes. Number two, there was a housing shortage in the city. Number three, government-assisted mortgage programs. Pretty good. Four, changing neighborhoods. Five, spiraling urban crime rate. Six, falling price of cars. Seven, wide new roads that shorten the commutes. And, obviously, rising affluence. And this caused nearly one-third of all Jews to move to the suburbs. And you ended up with a lot of people driving. And I'm saying a lot of people driving in all segments of Orthodox, of all segments of Judaism, both Orthodoxy, Conservative, and Reform. You did end up with a lot of people driving. Orthodox synagogues, even until this day, still keep their parking lots open on Shabbos. I remember growing up, my father was a rabbi of a Sephardic synagogue. His psak was no, that the parking lot is closed on Shabbat, so everyone used to park on the street. Listen, 90% of the people drove to shul. Okay, whatever, you know, Sephardic, you know, it is what it is, but you don't sanction it. However, if you read, for example, Tales Out of Shul by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, he describes leaving the parking lot open. And until this day in Atlanta, they still leave the parking lot open on Shabbos. And in fact, I was just in Boynton Beach on beach 2 Shabboses ago for a bar mitzvah. And they have a sign that says, just because our parking lot is open does not mean that we're condoning driving on Shabbos. Driving on Shabbos is wrong, but it's open. So as we're going to see, there's obviously a huge difference between Bidiyaved and Lechachila. That's going to end up being, in terms of, is it just the okay way or is it the best way? This is what we're going to discuss. And many Orthodox rabbis even served in mixed pew synagogues. I was shocked by this. 90% of HTC graduates, 90% Hebrew Theological College in Chicago, 90% of them were rabbis in mixed pew synagogues. From YU, the number is 50%. 50% of their rabbis. And Soloveitchik has a very famous line where he says, I don't care if it's 5% or 50%, it doesn't mean it's okay. It doesn't mean it's okay. And many, the YU shita, the YU stance was that is absolutely prohibited. They wouldn't even think about it. Now, they knew that many of their graduates were going to these mixed pew synagogues. They absolutely knew it. So Dr. Revel, he has a great line where he says, an able and diplomatic man could return an errant congregation from its ways. So that's really what it is, that you have an Orthodox rabbi who puts in a mechitza. Who did this? The aforementioned Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. And Lincoln Square Synagogue. That's the most famous case for Soloveitchik. He gave Rabbi Riskin 2 years. It's very famous. He gave Rabbi Riskin, you have 2 years to turn this place from a mixing synagogue to a mechitza synagogue. And that's what he gave him. However, as we're about to discuss the huge mistake that the conservative movement is going to make, Rav Soloveitchik did something that really marginalized conservative Judaism to a very, very large degree. And I'm not going to steal this from, I take that back. I am going to steal this from Rabbi Moskowitz, because I guarantee you he will quote this in 2 weeks. So pretend to be surprised. If you take a look at source 5, that comes from 1954. This is beautiful. You have to read it inside. Oh my gosh. It comes
It comes, I mean, it's been published multiple times, but it comes from commitment, covenant, and commitment, selected letters, and communications of Soloveitchik. It's great. It's like getting a snapshot of Orthodoxy during a period where it was really, really scary. And you see, Soloveitchik was so strong in terms of bringing it back. So, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, to make absolutely clear my position on this laden question, I would like to relate this incident. A young man moved into the suburb of Boston, where the only existing synagogue had men and women sitting together. He asked me what he should do on the High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Until then, on account of them exceeding, he had not entered the synagogue. But, Yamim Noraim, the days of awe, he was very reluctant to remain home. I answered him that it would be better for him to remain at home Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and not cross the threshold of the synagogue. A few days later, he telephoned me again. He had met the man who was to sound the shofar in the synagogue. And this man had warned him that if he did not come to the synagogue, he simply would not hear the shofar at all. For the man would not sound the shofar again, privately for his benefit. The young man practically implored me that I granted permission to enter the edifice, at least for half an hour, that he might hear the shofar blast. I hesitated not a moment, but directed him to remain at home. It would be better not to hear the shofar than to enter a synagogue whose sanctity has been profaned. Rav Soloveitchik drew a line in the sand. A conservative synagogue loses it. Yet, what really impacted the conservative movement long term is exactly what we're going to talk about tonight. I know this whole 37 minutes was my preamble, was the introduction. Now we get into the real stuff. What time is over? 10? Okay, all right. Oh my gosh. So let's look at who wrote this extremely famous tshuva, which I appended. Oh my gosh, there's a lot to talk about. Oh my gosh. We're going to get into some very, once again, to use an Ashkenazic term, some very Mishunadikka stories. Oh my gosh. So who was the very first person who's quoted? It is Rabbi Theodore Friedman. That's him over there. Thank you. I play basketball with my students. All right. I don't have the greatest ops. Rabbi Theodore Friedman, he was the most conservative, with a capital C, of the three. He went through JTS, American born, totally within the movement. So he's the very first one. He was a rabbi in the Oranges of a conservative temple, and he eventually became the president of the Rabbinical Assembly. And he passed away in 1992 in Yerushalayim. The second person is Rabbi Morris Adler. When I brought up this name, I was talking to my father-in-law about this, and he like shuddered, because Rabbi Morris Adler became unfortunately famous for something very, very sad, which we'll just discuss in a couple minutes. His father was Rav Yosef Adler, not from Teaneck, but Rav Yosef Adler. Rav Yosef Adler, according to Rav Yisrael Belsky's father, Rav Beryl, he said that Rav Yosef Adler was literally one of the Gedolei Hador, one of the greatest rabbis of his generation. And he actually started a yeshiva called MTJ, Misifta Tiferes Yerushalayim. And not only that, he was Rosh Yeshiva. And not only that, when Rav Moshe Feinstein ended up getting a visa to Toledo, Ohio, you better believe he wasn't going to stay there. When he got his visa to go to Ohio, who brought him in to be Rosh Yeshiva of MTJ? Rav Yosef Adler. Rav Morris Adler's father was Rav Yosef Adler. He died in an awful way. He was actually going to the mikvah early in the morning. Now, they didn't have men's mikvahot, really, around Coney Island. So where did he go? He went to the Atlantic Ocean. A riptide pulled him in, and they found his body miles and miles away. Miles away. Very, very, very sad. Very sad. Rabbi Morris Adler ends up going to MTJ originally, and then eventually ending up at the seminary, where he really does buy in. He becomes a conservative rabbi. In fact, he ends up becoming the rabbi of Shaarei Tzedek in Southfield, Michigan. And this is where it gets very, very scary. He died because there was a crazed person named Richard Wisniewski, age 24, who had just come back from Eretz Yisrael, and a couple mental institutions. And what happened was, he came in with a gun, he shot to the sky, and he ran up to the bima. He ran up to the very front. Rabbi Adler, he got everyone off of the bima, and he said, "Don't worry, I know this person. I understand he has mental issues." At this point, Richard Wisniewski, this is in all the newspapers, he screamed out, "This congregation is a travesty, an abomination. It has made a mockery by its phoniness and hypocrisy of the beauty and spirit of Judaism." Rabbi Morris Adler said, "Don't worry, I have this handled." This Richard Wisniewski shoots four times. The fourth time, the fourth shot, ends up going into Rabbi Adler's head, and he ends up dying only a couple weeks later. Richard Wisniewski turns the gun onto himself and commits suicide. His wife, Goldie, instead of running, she did rush over to her husband when she saw that he was being taken care of. She actually was comforting the Wisniewski family. Mrs. Wisniewski was crying. She couldn't believe it. And she said, "Don't worry, I understand. It's not your fault. It's not your family's fault." You could see she was a very, very important, you know, very, very refined person. 20,000 people attended his funeral, including Mitt Romney's father, George, who was the governor of Michigan. Really sad. And who was the third? The third rabbi was Rabbi Jacob Agus. Rabbi Jacob Agus, his brother is extremely famous. His brother was Dr. Irving Agus. Irving Agus was a longtime professor at Yeshiva University amongst YU students. He's famous for Rav Schechter, for failing Rav Schechter. What's the story? It's crazy. It's crazy. And I asked Rav Schechter about the story. He didn't want to talk about it, but I still got it from him. The whole story, I'll tell you guys maybe another time when I'm not going to go for 3 hours. So Rav Schechter heard kfira in the class. He heard something that was against the Torah. The halacha is in Shulchan Aruch that if you hear kfira, what are you supposed to do? You tear kriya. Rav Schechter got up, tore kriya, and ran out. Dr. Agus gave him an F. Later on, when Yeshiva University appointed him to be Rosh Yeshiva at the age of 26, they were looking and they said, "You didn't graduate. Because you have this F over here." So he took a Revel course, and eventually, don't worry, Rav Schechter does have a college degree. It's fascinating. So Jacob Agus, he was very, very traditional. In fact, he got smicha from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik's father, who passed away in 1941. However, he ends up going to Harvard, getting a PhD from the Divinity School, and unfortunately becomes a conservative rabbi, and ends up writing this tshuva. So let us now take a look at this responsive inside. Oh my gosh. I know. Was that enough of an introduction? Let's take a look at it. So I'll be saying the numbers are on the bottom of the page over here. It starts on page 177. A responsum on the Sabbath. Should be, I think, the 6th or 7th page in. So the responsum are really about two different things. It's about electricity and driving. And they end up saying that really it's both the same halakha. That's what they end up saying. So they're dealing with an issue, and they have an even longer preamble than I have. They go on and on about the suburbs, about Jews moving to the suburbs, and how do you get these Jews involved? And all you have to do is basically explain to them about Judaism, and they'll be totally into it. They will. And they are worried about two different things: defection to the Reform and assimilation. And they're also worried about maybe alleviating some of the guilt that people have in terms of driving. Whether or not, I know this as a Sephardic person, once again, my dad's shul, 90% of the people used to drive. If you even ask them, nobody would say it's mutter to drive. They drove, but they, you know, they think it's maybe a minhag. Okay, fine, whatever. Take a look over here on page 180. Page 180. And take a look at letter G. On page 180, this is what they write. "Refraining from the use of a motor vehicle is an important aid in the maintenance of the Sabbath spirit of repose. Such restraint aids, moreover, in keeping the members of the family together on the Sabbath. However, where a family resides beyond reasonable walking distance from the synagogue, the use of a motor vehicle for the purpose of synagogue attendance shall in no wise be construed as a violation of Sabbath, but on the contrary, such attendance shall be deemed an expression of loyalty to our faith." I even wrote, when I read this the first time, a huge exclamation point. Not only is it non-avera to drive,
It's a mitzvah to come to shul. It's a mitzvah. Now the rest of this, Rabbi Stephen Przanski from Bnei Yeshurun in Teaneck, he has an amazing shiur about this without all of the, you know, preamble. And he, a lot of what I'm about to say really comes from him, especially this next source. How on earth does someone come to this type of, I guess, misunderstanding of how halakha works? So he brings a very, very influential book by Max I. Diamond on page, it happens to be on page 2. It happens to be source 6. Max I. Diamond, Jews, God, and History. I actually had a Talmud. I know it's an old book. They made it, his widow actually made, I think in the early 90s, a new edition to it. I mean, this was like the book in the 1950s. The book. One of my students actually brought in Hillel Day School, a sixth grader, brought in the book. He had read the book and he said, "Rabbi, this is a little bit weird to me." And I'm like, "Actually, yes." And he totally disagreed with it, as you will see. Let us illustrate. Let us illustrate how the responsa worked with an example from life today. Let us suppose that the yeshivas of Babylon still exist and that a Jewish community in suburban St. Louis had asked one of them to solve the vexing problem of the automobile, the suburb, and the synagogue. This is the dilemma. The Torah forbids work on the Sabbath in 1900 AD. Yes, I added the exclamation point. I think that's funny. All right. A yeshiva court ruled that driving a car is work. Now, many years later, the suburbs have developed. The synagogue no longer is a few blocks away, but miles out in the country, and the distance is too formidable to walk. The congregation is faced with the prospect of an empty synagogue or committing the sin of driving to the place of worship. What should be done? Top of page 3. The question is turned over to the yeshiva, and the problem is placed on the docket. When the case comes up, the yeshiva court will begin a hearing, much as the Supreme Court reviews a case. The argument might go something like this. Certainly, God did not intend to have empty synagogues, nor to have his commandments broken. But who said that driving to the synagogue was work? Certainly not God or Moses. To force the aged to walk for miles in the hot sun or in the cold of winter is a peril to the health. You know, pikuach nefesh. Attending services should be contemplated with joy, not with fear and trembling. Which is interesting. There's a pasuk in Tehillim, Gilu Berada. Okay, whatever. Did not the sages say that he who takes upon himself a duty that is not specifically required is an ignoramus? And furthermore, did not Rabbi Judah ben Ezekiel, back in the 3rd century, say that he who would order his entire life according to strict and literal interpretation of Scripture is a fool? The yeshiva court would then begin a search for precedents, just as lawyers arguing a brief before the Supreme Court would search for precedents favorable to their case. After due deliberation, the court back in 1900 had erred, and that driving a car to the synagogue is not work, but pleasure. First of all, it's totally not true. Anyone that drives, especially here in South Florida, is not pleasure. Much in the same way that the United States Supreme Court in the 1890s held that equal but separate facilities for the Negroes was constitutional, when the 1950s reversed itself, holding that it was unconstitutional. Once a verdict is reached, it's sent to the other yeshivas where similar hearings are held, and a joint agreement disseminated through the responsa to every Jewish community. Now, it's very interesting, this Dr. Diamond, I don't know, it's a very interesting way of thinking about halakha. That is not how halakha works, especially when you have a pasuk in the Torah. The third pasuk in Parsha Vayakel is Lo tivaru esh b'chol moshotechem b'yom haShabbat. Don't kindle fire on Shabbos. Don't do it. Not allowed. So the other problem is that in this quote unquote, you know, keta, this little paragraph I showed you guys, what's the very first thing that he does? He said, how does God feel about having empty synagogues? That's such a feeling that's so anathema to us. No, Hashem has already told us how he feels by giving us a Torah. That's what we need to do. It's not for anybody to think about what God's quote-unquote intentions are. He's made it very, very clear in the Torah. Okay, the next part that I find to be really interesting. I read through the tshuva, and as someone that has a little bit of background in Talmud, you know, being a rabbi and all, if you take a look, it's peppered throughout with very, very strange, like, rabbinic dictums that if you just look at them, they seem to make sense, but then when you look at the original context, it all falls apart and it makes you wonder. You're like, what? Like, this doesn't make sense at all. So please take a look at page 181. 181. I know, I wish we could go through the whole tshuva. Oh my gosh, it's fascinating. So please take a look at the very beginning. Very beginning on page 181. It says on the very first three words are Ein Shvut B'Mikdash, which means the Sabbath prohibition of Shvut, which is a mitzvah derabanan, which is a derabanan, an enactment by the rabbis, does not apply to the carrying out of the temple ritual. What they want to prove over here is very interesting. It sounds great, right? So therefore, our batei kenesiot, our shuls, are a mikdash me'at. Ours are very tiny, miniature temples. So it would seem to be, if you look at this, and for me, I was reading this, I almost fell out of my bed. Ein shvut b'mikdash, what does that have to do with apples and oranges? It has nothing to do with anything. But what they want to prove from over here is that they want to say that since already it's okay to do a quote-unquote Isser Derabanan, to go against the rabbinic enactment on Shabbos, if they can show that driving a car is only a rabbinic Isser, is only a rabbinic prohibition, it would therefore be totally mutter to drive to shul on Shabbos. This is not the way halakha works. I'm telling you, even people who don't really understand halakha, even they realize that this is not the way it works. Example number two. Take a look. It keeps on going. I'm telling you, it bothers me because once again, I know about the background. I don't know so much about Theodore Friedman, but I know about the background of Morris Adler. I know about Jacob Agus's background. I know it. And they must have known that these proofs were spurious, and they knew that the stuff is just sophistry. I mean, for example, take a look at the third paragraph down. Starts with, at the same time. At the same time, we must learn to adjust our strategy to realities of our time and place, in keeping with the realistic genius of the great builders of our faith. Thus, our sages cautioned us, tafasta meruba, lo tafasta. What does that line mean? It says, to overreach is to court failure. So the way I understood it is that they're saying, what should we do? We shouldn't demand too much from a generation that's disenfranchised. So therefore, we should allow this, and therefore, hopefully, they'll come back. At least that's the way I understood it. However, if you really see what the line tafasta meruba lo tafasta means, is really a halachic term all about comparing different types of halachic things. Nothing to do with a general outlook on life. I don't even want to go into it because, I mean, we're so late already. All right, moving on. Go, please, also, on page 181, go to the end of paragraph 1. It says, it is also well to remember the sage advice. The last sentence. Mutav shelo lomar davar she'eno nishma. It is better not to say a thing which will not be heeded. This is an extremely specific idea about the halachot of tochacha. If I have to give rebuke to somebody, that's what it's about. It has nothing to do with allowing driving on Shabbos. And it keeps on getting worse. Please go to page 182. And remember, I am no rabbinic scholar. Take a look at the end of paragraph 2. It says a very famous line, Mutav sheyu shogigim, the Alu Mizidim. It's at the end of the second paragraph in source 3 over there on page 182. Number 3, the very last sentence is Mutav Shiyu Shogigin the Alu Mizidin, which means it's better that people do something by mistake rather than tell them, and therefore they will still continue doing it. The Gemara Beitza gives the context of what that means. Really, a person is not supposed to clap on Shabbos. However, the Gemara says, it quotes the Tana, who says, you know what, better not to tell them, because you know why? It's okay, it's not a problem. And there's a famous Tosvos on that, Mitakin Klishir. Don't want to get into that. But the whole point is, Mutav, Sheyu, Shokigin, Valu, Mazidin, is only referring to at most an Isser Derabanan. An Isser Derabanan. In fact, we know that if something is explicit, Davar HaMefurosh B'Torah, as is brought down in Yevamos Dav Dalid, if something is very much known in the Torah, you can't rely on this type of, see no evil. You can't do this. So how can you say we're going to allow driving on Shabbat because Mutav Yushogigan? It doesn't work by anything that's in the Torah. I remember I had the ability, thank God, Baruch Hashem. I used to go, my wife and I know I've mentioned this a million times, we used to have a deal that I would go to Rav Avadi Yosef's house on Moshe Shabbos and hear his shiur, me along with 200 of our closest friends, and I would go ahead and hear the shiur as long as I did the dishes on Moshe Shabbos, which is a good deal for me. So Chacham Avadia told an amazing story when he was a rabbi in Cairo right after Hakamat Medina, right after 1948. When he was a rabbi in Cairo, what happened was that there was a big problem. No one was religious anymore in Egypt. So he was the Av based in, and it became a big problem because for all things that require Edus, you need two. So you have one, you have Rav Avadia. Who's going to be the second rabbi? Who's going to be the second from Jew? He couldn't find anybody except for the shamash, for the, I don't even know what the English term, the beagle, sexton. Oh, I love those terms. Oh, amazing. That's exactly what I was thinking. No one uses those anymore. Amazing. So the shamash, Rav Avadia said, 6 months in, Chacham Avadia, and this sexton had been signing gittin, had been signing divorce documents, had been signing marriage documents, all sorts of important things. And 6 months into Rav Avadia's stay in Egypt, they're sitting in the shul together, and Rav Avadia leans over to him and he says, "Hey, what electric shaver do you use?" The guy leans over, he says, "Rav Avadia, I don't know what you're talking about. I shave with a tar. I shave with a razor, which is explicitly prohibited by the Torah." Chacham Avadia says, his face turned white. Every single divorce document, every single marriage document, it becomes a huge problem. It would end up being that a couple wouldn't be married. Okay, big deal, whatever, get married again. But the divorce is much worse, because if a woman goes ahead and gets remarried, whatever product, whatever child she has is a mom's heir. So Chacham Avadia was stuck. He couldn't believe it. And this is one person. Rav Avadia said they end up buying this fellow an electric shaver, which is very cool. That's why I use an electric shaver. So what happens is, Chacham Avadia, he ended up finding a very famous, I shouldn't say he made it famous, very famous Rabbi Kiva Eger, that said that if a person didn't know it was in the Torah, then it might be okay. But he told this person, you're not allowed to shave anymore with a razor. So as we see over here from the story, it has to be things that are not in the Torah. If it's something that, if a person would come to shul and hear it from laning, that is not good enough for mutav shiyu shogigin v'alyu mezidin. It's not good enough. Continuing on, example number 5. It keeps on going. Oh my gosh. I honestly am sad about this. I'm not joking. Take a look at the end of the third paragraph. It says, desecrate for him one Sabbath in order that he might keep many Sabbaths. I mean, it honestly pains me, because you take a look at Maseches Beitza, which is where this comes from, Daf Pei Hei. What's this referring to? It's one of the Mekorot, it's one of the sources for saving a person's life on Shabbos. We're not saying a person should drive one Shabbos, so therefore they could keep multiple Shabboses. Not at all. Oh, I'm telling you. Oh, okay. So that's, I mean, it's just so strange. It just keeps on, okay. Let us continue with the halachic arguments that they bring. And if you weren't impressed with all these rabbinic dictums that made no sense in context, then you're definitely not going to be swayed by this. Please take a look at the bottom of page 182. The problem of writing, and keep this very much in mind, because they conflate. And I fail to think that it was really by accident, but they keep on using the word writing. We'll get to that in a few minutes. So take the bottom of page 182. The use of an automobile involves the following activities: the kindling of lights, the indirect combustion of gasoline to produce power, and locomotion from one domain to another. This is the line. The combustion of gasoline to produce power is a type of work that obviously could not have been prohibited before its invention. They used an argument that even my sixth grade students, my sixth grade low class, would never bring. Rabbi, why are computers usher on Shabbos? They weren't around during the times that the rabbis, that, you know, that the Torah was given. I mean, we all know 39 malachos, 39 avos malachos, 39 main categories of prohibitions were made by Hashem. And Hashem said that these are the prohibitions, including havara, turning on and kindling. And it keeps on getting worse. This next part is gonna, if anyone, you know, if you're familiar with the halakha, it kills you. Take a look at page 183. It's three lines down. Of course, some heat is produced in the act of combustion, but this result is neither intended nor desired for the motorist. Hence, it falls in the category of a psik resha delo nichale. What's a psik resha delo nichale? It comes from the Gemara. It's an action that you know is going to cause an issur on Shabbos, but since you don't care about the result, therefore, it could be okay. No. We end up saying in the Gemara, it's not okay. Whatever, that's a whole different discussion. But what's fascinating is, it means that over here, that you don't want to kindle the fire. You just want to drive the car. Can anyone see the problem with this? This is absolutely a psik resha. Denichale. This is something that the person who operates the car, think about it. If the ignition would not turn on, you better believe the person would be pretty upset. It is absolutely nichale. And you're seeing what they're trying to do. They're trying to make driving onto a lower level. And it keeps on getting worse. If you take a look, it says, which is permitted by the latest authorities. The combustion, we're three lines down in the first paragraph on page 183. The combustion of gas in the carburetor is therefore the type of work classed as a malacha she'ena tzricha legufa. Malacha she'ena tzricha legufa. Which means, it even tells you what it means over here. It's a labor, while is necessary, results in a transgression, is neither intended nor desired. Thus, malacha she'ena tzricha legufa is a labor which is not performed for its own sake. It says the malacha she'ena tzricha legufa. One famous example of this is, let's say I want to go ahead and dig a pit, but I don't want to dig a pit to go ahead and make a pit, which would happen to be one of the malachas of Shabbos. However, I want the dirt. I don't want to make the pit, I just want the dirt. So that happens to be an iser derabanan. And according to Rabbi Shimon, it's Pater Ava Aser. So according to what these rabbis are saying over here, they're saying that when you turn on the car, you don't really want the malacha to happen. And even that, it ends up explaining it in a way that we absolutely don't hold like. Tosfos, and they're very much into this Tosfos, Tosfos quotes the Ri. The Ri says that any malacha that's done not in the same manner as it was done in the Mishkan is automatically lowered to a malacha she'ena tzricha legufa, and according to them, it's okay. So that would mean, and I wrote this down, I got this from Rabbi Bodner Sefer on Hilchos Shabbos, it would mean that heating the vats of dyes required for dyeing the urea, the wool coverings of the Mishkan, as long as you're not doing that, it's only an issur derabanan. There's so many problems with this line of thinking, namely that no normative posek holds this way. And he keeps on going about how it's all within the shita of Rabbi Shimon. And there's a big problem, and I don't want to get into this, because wow, I can't believe I've already finished, you know, done an hour and 4 minutes. I don't want to keep everybody for so long. But if you keep on looking into it, you'll see we don't even paskin like Rabbi Shimon in the Gemara. So their whole hanacha, their whole understanding is already, it's a non-starter for anyone who learns Talmud. So, as Rabbi Przanski points out, the authors never ever talk about driving. They always are talking about riding. That becomes another issue, because according to these rabbis, who do you think is driving? It's a Jewish person driving. The halacha is, a person's not allowed to benefit from malacha, which is done by another Jewish person for a Jewish person.
So it would even mean that even if it was a Jewish person riding, that would be not allowed. I'm not going to get into the issue of a non-Jewish person driving, but once again, that's also a very, very big problem. Very big problem. So we happen to have in our community someone named Rabbi Jerry Epstein. He is fascinating. He used to be part of the Rabbinical Assembly. He happens to be my student, is Naftali Kiefer, if you know the Kiefers. So it's his grandfather. And he's fascinating. He told me that at the time, and I did not know this, this is not found anywhere. At the time, in order to ratify something for the Rabbinical Assembly, you needed 6 rabbis to agree out of 25. That is not a majority. And in fact, thank you, I know, you guys came for that part. So what happens is that even at the time, the scholars of JTS blasted it. For example, Shaul Lieberman thought it was ridiculous. Louis Ginsberg thought it was ridiculous. Alexander Marx thought it was ridiculous. Chaim Jimotrovsky thought it was ridiculous. All of these people saw this tshuva for what it was. Substandard scholarship. Like the conclusion, whatever. It's just bad scholarship. It doesn't make any sense. And even into the late 1960s, it was a tremendous embarrassment for JTS for someone to drive. In fact, this is brought down by Sarna. Please take a look at page 1, source 3. William B. Rubin. This is hilarious. Then the elderly president of Tootsie Roll Industries and philanthropist. He was driven to JTS every Shabbat in his limo. An embarrassment at JTS where driving on the Sabbath was frowned on. Even though it was considered acceptable by the Conservative Movement's Committee on Jewish Law since 1960. Rubin was honored in the hope that he would leave the seminary a large legacy, which as far as I know, did not happen. Did not happen. Oh my gosh, I love that. Oh my gosh, it's great. So why is this like a moment that mattered? Now we're finally... There's so much more we could talk about. I'm cutting out like probably half of what we need to do, but this is amazing. So why should this be a moment that mattered? So we'll see in just a moment. So number one, because of this psak, conservative Judaism lost all of its credibility in terms of being a serious halachic movement. As we saw in the early 20th century, there was very small distinction between YU and between JTS. They even almost merged twice. However, this was a major, major break. And how do we know that this is so spurious? How do we know this is so problematic? Because Machon Schechter, in 1990, and I provide you the entire tshuva, it happens to be source 9 over here, the same question was asked in Israel by the Masorati movement, the conservative movement in Israel. You can probably guess what they said. You can read the tshuva by yourself. They say it's absolutely prohibited. They say you're not allowed to drive on Shabbos. In fact, the ending is amazing. Take a look at the bottom of page 5. This is after number 10. There are, however, 3 possible solutions to the question that was asked. Number 1, effort should be renewed to found a Masorati synagogue in Petach Tikva. Number 2, just because a mechitza is not necessary does not mean that it is forbidden. We should not be as intolerant as those who refuse to pray in our synagogues. It's better to walk to an Orthodox synagogue on Shabbat than to drive to a Masorati synagogue. Number 3, and I love this, because this you see the whole world coming full circle. It is also possible to move near a Masorati synagogue. This may be an expensive or inconvenient solution. But Jews have traditionally made great sacrifices in order to observe mitzvot. If people move to another city for the sake of a good job or a good school, why shouldn't they move for the sake of living near the kehillah of their choice? Oh my. And in fact, if you take a look at source 9, this comes from my cousin-in-law. He has an amazing sefer called Modern Orthodox Judaism. Oh no, not source 9. My fault. I take that back. Never mind. All right. Question. Sorry about that. Yeah. We have another source coming up. Don't worry. Also for my cousin. Okay. So, number 1, they lose all credibility. Number two, there was a change in the methodology for conservative psak. No longer was it source-based, but they made a predetermined result, and they basically ended up drawing the target around where they put the arrow. Becomes a big, big problem. And in fact, this continues happening over and over again.
the conservative movement, and this is once again super, super sad, they waited until Saul Lieberman passed away in 1983 to start ordaining women. While Saul Lieberman was alive, they wouldn't do it. But when he passed away, that's what happened. And that's why you end up with, for example, Rabbi Josef Faur, who learned in Lakewood under Rav Aaron. He has a whole tshuva dedicated to him in Yabia Omer. He left the seminary in the early 1980s. And my favorite person in the entire world, basically, which would be, oh man, I can't believe it, I'm blanking on it. Oh, Rabbi Weiss Halivni, sorry about that. Rabbi David Weiss Halivni, he ends up leaving the conservative movement also. When I was in Israel, I used to spend time with him. I actually davened with him. And it's hilarious, because he has a very famous line. You know, he's very liberal when it comes to learning. He's JTS when it comes to learning. His line is, those people that I learn with, I can't pray with, but those people I pray with, I can't learn with. So we were in a minyan, and I'm like, by pointing to my, I'm like, Dominic, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm praying with Dr. Weiss Halivni. I don't know, I thought that was super cool. And, you know what? If all fails, it's very easy. You just say, Nishtanu atevaim, you say times have changed, everything's totally different. Number three, Shabbat was totally lost. A friend of mine from the conservative movement was retiring, and he asked his assistant to find for him a Shomer Shabbos conservative community. For 8 years, this person looked around the country, looked around America, to find a community that was Shomer Shabbos. Not one community was in America. Not one. He ended up moving to an Orthodox community. You know, B'dieved, whatever. So what happens is, oh my gosh, it's crazy. Crazy. Number four, there are no halachic demands. There's no mesiras nefesh. You don't need to do anything. It's very, very hard. I mean, you lose basically the entire understanding of Judaism if you're not dealing with this type of struggle. And number five, it eliminated, and this is exactly what Dr. Jerry Epstein talks about, it eliminated the need for a community in general, because why? Shul is just a place to daven. It's not for community. It's just a place to daven. And that means you can live wherever you want. And that's exactly why, in the conservative world, I just checked this up today, 75% intermarriage rate. 3 out of every 4 conservative Jews will marry out of Judaism, which is exactly why they're currently debating this issue. And now please turn to source 4. This is from my cousin. And don't worry, we're almost done. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. I really, really. Source 4. His name is Zev Elif, Rabbi Dr. Zev Elif. He learned by Jonathan Sarna at Brandeis, and he was in Rosh Hashanah with myself. Oh my gosh, it's awesome. And he brings this. He has a great book, and he quotes from Rabbi Charles Eliezer Calver, a rabbi in Denver, Colorado, of a conservative synagogue. Dear Rabbi Blumenthal, who is the president of the Rabbinical Assembly of America, after long consideration, I have reached a decision regretfully to tender herewith my resignation for Rabbinical Assembly of America for the following reasons. Having been one of the organizers of the Rabbinical Assembly, I know that it was the intention of the founders of the Rabbinical Assembly to be an instrument to cherish and promote traditional Judaism in an ideal American setting without deviating in any way from Torah true Judaism. That's amazing. It sounds like you're reading from like Hamudia, you know, Torah true Judaism. Unfortunately, in the past 15 or 20 years, the leaders of the Rabbinical Assembly have chosen to introduce a new, quote-unquote, philosophy of Judaism. They have condoned changes and innovations and interpretations which, in my judgment, are contrary to the spirit and to the letter of the Torah, and which are not consistent with the principles upon which the Jewish Theological Seminary, the Rabbinical Assembly, and United States and United Synagogue were founded. The protests of these members of the Rabbinical Assembly, who have remained true to the original pattern, have been ignored and at times ridiculed. I therefore wish to sever my affiliation with the Rabbinical Assembly of America, effective immediately. So during Hurricane Irma, we're almost done. During Hurricane Irma, my wife and I, we were scaredy cats, what can I say? We ran to Atlanta. And Rabbi Feldman, Rabbi Ilan Feldman, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman's son, So he was there, and he told a crazy story. He said that he was in Houston helping people earlier in the week, and he was hoping to have a quiet Shabbos. He was hoping to have a quiet Shabbos. Little did he know, 1,200 Jewish families came from South Florida. We had an amazing Shabbos, I'm telling you, inspiring. Every single driveway had 2 to 3 different license plates from Florida. What a Kiddush Hashem. But yet on Friday morning, Rabbi Feldman was invited to come to one of these big things for the Federation. There was a rabbi's meeting at the Federation, and it was concerning having a conservative, or I should say egalitarian minion at the Kotel. And Rabbi Feldman said, he said, listen, I know I'm super, super busy, but I have to go because all the other rabbis of the Federation, or Reform and Conservative Reconstructionists, Mordechai Kaplan, until you come back again, all of that, who's going to represent Orthodoxy? So he walked in, and everyone stood up for him, and everyone started clapping. Oh, Rabbi Feldman, oh, this has been all over the news. What a great person. Look, what is a community. And as Rabbi Feldman was sitting down, he overheard two rabbis who were not Orthodox. And one of them leaned over and said, you know why? Because these people have to do it. Because they're Orthodox. And they can't drive on Shabbat. They have to. And Rabbi Feldman said, now if you know Rabbi Feldman, he doesn't hold his tongue. So he said he tried holding his tongue, which is a lot for him. He tried holding his tongue and not saying anything, but he got so upset. He said, it's not that we have to. It's obviously because we want to, because we're bound by mitzvot. All of us have something in common. We're all close to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. We're all following his will. That's what we're doing. And in fact, he asked them, and this is a great question. He said, where are the myriads of people coming to Atlanta to the Reform and the Conservative congregations there running away from Hurricane Irma? There was none. Now let's finish. Go to the very last page. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. This is not from me. I wish I could take credit for this. This comes from Rabbi J.J. Schachter of YU, Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter. It is incredible. This is from June 1941. And very famous line, there's a refuah before the makkah. Which means Hashem always makes sure that even when things are at its very nadir, when things are so bad, Hashem makes sure that there's going to be light. And where is this light? This page over here, J.J. Schachter, it's amazing. Take a look at this. On the top right, this is June 1941, Hashir HaRishon B'Yeshiva. It tells about Rav Soloveitchik's first year taking over for his father and becoming Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, obviously having a tremendous impact on American Orthodoxy. Look down. The next one is Hagaon Rav Aaron Cutler Shlita. It's announcing that Rav Aaron Cutler had come through Japan, through San Francisco, which is where I'm from, San Francisco to New York. And it's saying that he's now living, you can even see the very last line, he's living at 160 West 95th Street in New York. Rav Aaron Cutler comes to the shores of America. Keep on going down. Agudas Yisrael, Bei America. It's all about Rav Lazer Silver, one of the top students of Rav Chaim Lazer Grzesinski. It talks about Rav Lazer Silver setting up Agudas Yisrael in Canada. And then, take a look on the left over here. Chag Hanachat HaEven LeMosad Binyan Shel Yeshiva Ner Yisrael, Baltimore, Maryland. It is putting in the cornerstone of Yeshivas Ner Yisrael under the stewardship of Rav Ruderman. The point is that even though when things look so bad, aside from the fact that conservative Judaism made this mistake, Hashem never ever leaves us alone. And even at the lowest, lowest times of Judaism, Hashem always is there for us. Thank you so, so much.